Tonight on Arena, Viggo Mortensen talks to us about writing, directing and acting in his new film, The Dead Don't Hurt, and we review Kevin Barry's new novel, The Heart in Winter. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Nice to be back in the seat after a little break over the bank holiday weekend. Now, over his decades-long career, the Oscar-nominated actor Viggo Mortensen has brought vigour and intensity to his roles, whether as an anarchist dad in Captain Fantastic, a chauffeur in The Green Book, or as kingly hero Aragorn in The Lord of the Rings, a job which brought him global fame. But when he's not working with directors like Peter Jackson and David Cronenberg, Viggo Mortensen himself can be found directing, not to mention writing, producing, acting and composing, all on one project. The Dead Don't Hurt is his second feature as a writer-director, and it's a western of sorts. He stars in it as Holger Olsen, a Danish veteran who has come to the United States as tensions threaten to spill over into civil war. He meets the formidable French-Canadian woman Vivienne, played by Vicky Creeps. Together, they make a life for themselves in rural Nevada, only for it to be disrupted by conflicts near and far. I spoke to Viggo Mortensen earlier today about this latest project. Before I bring you that conversation, let's hear a moment from the film when Vivienne and Olsen encounter each other for the first time in San Francisco.
Olsen.
First Olsen?
Just Olsen.
Vivienne?
Just Vivienne.
Vivienne Le Cousy.
Oh. Enchanté. Vous êtes française?
Non.
You're not American.
Yes, I am.
You don't sound like it.
And neither do you.
I know that your first feature, Viggo, was inspired by your mother falling, but it was very much, it was a parent-child, the intricacies of that relationship and a much more contemporary feel to it. Here we are now in The Dead Don't Hurt in 1860s America, frontier America, but yet your mother was a kind of an inspiration here once again.
Yeah, it's true. The first image that came to me was of this little girl that you see in the film running around in a forest in the northeast of the United States, right on the Canadian border, you know, maples, red oaks, black walnuts. And that little girl who's very stubborn and very independent, with a vivid imagination, very much her own person, grows up to be a woman just like that, very free-thinking, independent woman, played by Vicky Creeps, wonderful actress, and she does a fantastic job in the part. That was the first thing that came to me. I was thinking, okay, where do we put such a woman, you know? And I thought, let's put her on the Western frontier in the 19th century, 1860s, because that's a place where she's going to face, you know, great obstacles. Mm. It's going to be a big challenge for her to be how she is in a place that's essentially lawless, dominated by a few powerful, unscrupulous men who are not averse to using violence to achieve their aims. And that'll just make it tougher for her. And that's how it ended up being a Western.
And the link to your mother there is quite interesting, I think.
Well, her personality, my mom was like Vivienne, an ordinary woman, you know, by and large, you know, a woman conditioned by the times she lived in, you know, mother of three boys, housewife, but someone who was always, like Vivienne, curious about other cultures, languages, people, movies, music, someone who'd like to challenge herself and did not really take no for an answer when it came to doing something she wanted to do or learning something she wanted to learn. She was like that her whole life. So it was kind of, Vivienne is inspired by her.
and that wonderful independence that she has. It's played so lightly, I would have to say, by Vicky Creeps. You know, there's not an ounce. I didn't see one ounce of overacting. It was beautifully tempered in that respect. And she has to deal with some right bios, as we might say in this part of the world, in both the setting in the period and the setting itself. And there's one Irish fella chasing her gloriously at the beginning of the film, Lewis Cartwright, played by Colin Morgan.
Yeah, Colin was great, and he did that, play that part perfectly, and it was an honor and a privilege to have him there to play that part. He just lifted that section of the movie just by his talent, his presence, and he really came prepared. Yeah,
no, he does a beautiful job, as you say. But interesting for us in this part of the world is his Irish accent. And it's not just him that has the Irish accent, of course. You are playing, because you are part of this film, not just the director. We'll talk about the multi-roles in a little bit. You are playing the character of Olsen, a Danish man who is in that part of the world as well. And Vicky Creeps, the character Vivian, has this French background to her, French-Canadian background to her. I guess that's what The Frontier gave you. It really was a melting pot of that nature. There are lots of other ethnicities and nationalities represented as well.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, it's true historically. And even though, I mean, yes, in other Westerns, you often see Mexicans or Irish people, Chinese, you know, or a movie, say, like Heaven's Gate, you have Eastern Europeans and Germans speaking their language and so forth. But by and large, nearly always the lead characters in Westerns are almost always Anglo-Saxon, native-born, you know, U.S. or Canada at most. And in this case, our two leads are, as you say, they don't have English as their first language. And but they are very much, you know, there's a scene in which when they meet and I hear her accent, when I first hear her, and I say, oh, well, you're French. And she says, no. I said, well, you're not American. She says, yes, I am. I said, well, you don't sound like it. And she says, well, neither do you. and that's, you know, I mean, it was as important to get the, let's say, the saddles and the lamps and the clothing and all the details correct. It was just as important to get the languages right and the cultural, racial, ethnic diversity, you know, right. And you don't often, it's not always that you really get that cross-section in Westerns. And I think it's important. You know, it's only if you're in denial or you're just ignorant that you think today or then the U.S. was, you know, America for Americans or, you know, make America great again. What does that mean? It's code for white Christians, you know, I suppose, in many quarters. And that's just not reality. It's any more than saying English for the English or France for the French. You know, it's like, what is that? It's always been a mixed bag. Unless you are a Native American indigenous person, even in a small town like our fictional town of Elk Flats, Nevada, you came from many different places and you will sound different and look different.
And you mentioned Just Like Today, and that's what struck me most about that aspect. It allowed the film, perhaps, even though set in 1860s and on the frontier, the Western frontier, it allowed it to be a very modern film. And in particular, it allowed Vivian, the character played by Vicky Creeps, to be an incredibly modern woman in that she's independent, she's very much got her own agency, etc. But I wondered, you know, in your researches and in looking at that period, in fact, was it women like that who survived well in that type of environment? People like that?
Yeah, I mean, there were lots of Vivians. It's just that those stories haven't been told, you know, whether at the time in newspapers or contemporary accounts, novels. The story of the Vivians of the West are few and far between because there wasn't an interest from the storytellers or the people telling those the history of that time. And then when movies started, screenplays started to be written, same thing, you know, it was like, okay, what are the men up to really? And the women are supportive, they're pretty or they're vulnerable or You know, there have been Westerns where women have played central roles, but normally they are powerful women, yeah. unusual, extraordinary women. They're big, own big ranches, like, say, Barbara Stanwyck in 40 Guns, or even in The Furies, yeah. or, you know, movies like that. Or Claudia Cardinale in there. She's not the central character, but she's important in one of Sergio Leone's movies. Marlene Dietrich, but they're unusual.
Yes.
You know, they're so spectacularly unique. And what's great about Vivian is it's just a woman.
Yeah. She's
a normal, well, she's an ordinary in many ways woman. And I think that's important.
That duck. It was moving very high and fast. Where did you learn to shoot like that?
I killed my first rabbit when I was 5 years old.
By yourself?
With an arrow. My father was with me, but he did not help. I cleaned it and cooked it also.
You are more handy every passing day.
Handy?
Useful. Capable.
Also, we explored something that I'd never seen, and you rarely see in any genre, not just Westerns, which is when the man goes to war, we go with the man and we go to war.
Yeah.
In this case, he rides literally out of shot. We don't even pan yeah. with him as he... We stay with her and for quite some time. And that was something that we wanted to explore. I was curious about what happens to little girls when their fathers go to war, as we see happen with yes. young Vivian. Or women like Vivian, what happens when their partners go off to war, or let's say their sons or brothers or what have you. What do they get up to? You know, the normal thing is to show...
The guy at war.
So, yeah, you show the guy in the war and he suffers. He comes, returns battle scarred mentally, physically, whatever. He's gone through a lot and we empathize with that. And then we've almost forgotten about her. And then he comes home, and if long enough has gone by, she's maybe dead, yeah. or which is very sad for him, of course. And or maybe she's run off with another, she's married someone else. You know, too much time has yeah. passed, and that's very sad for him. Or she runs to him tearfully, beaming, and embraces him and welcomes him home tearfully, you know. And that's great for him. But what about her? What has yes. she been up to? What yeah. are the consequences for her, for those girls, those women? Yeah. And I thought it was interesting to explore that.
And you certainly do. And that's it. We stay with her. And it also struck me there are not many Westerns that have acute meat in them. But you mentioned the scene earlier on where they first meet each other. This is not a romantic comedy, let us be absolutely clear. But
no, but it is a love story.
Yeah, yeah. And it does play. Is it you playing with the Western genre? Was that a very conscious type of approach you wanted to take?
I didn't think about, you mean about the...
Yeah, the overall movie? Shape of the film and all of that. And the way you're kind of pulling apart some of those ideas of the Western that, you know, let's not go to war, let's stay in the small town with the woman who's left behind, that type of thing.
I wasn't thinking I'm playing with something. I just was curious, you know. I thought, well, I'd like to see a story like that. And so I guess I'll write it, you know, and try to make a movie out of it. Yeah. It's basically that. I didn't, you know, my point of departure wasn't like conceptual. It's like, oh, I'm yeah. going to make a political statement or something, or even compare it to now. I think any story where human beings really seem like human beings and have real or realistic seeming problems and obstacles and relationships, you're naturally going to compare it yeah. to your own family, yeah. even if it's set in the Middle Ages, you know. If it's done well, you know, let's say you watch Lord of the Rings, it's a fantasy, but if the people are interacting in a credible way and the emotional stakes are credible, you're going to relate it to your own life, your own struggles, or your own family, your own community, you know. And I think that happens with any movie that's a story that's more or less well told.
And that love story is so central to the film, as you say, Viggo. There were certain scenes, like beautiful where the chemistry between yourself and Vicky Creeps was so incredible. I thought, how can he step from behind the camera into that scene? And did you just have to leave Viggo director over on the seat and let Viggo actor take over when you got on set?
Well, the director's still there. And in a strange way, which sounds, you wouldn't think so, but in a way, I think I'm more efficient, more focused as an actor when I'm also directing. It is more tiring, and I prefer, to be honest, the days where I didn't have to act as well, where I was just directing, because I could just be on the set all the time. I didn't have to run off and get changed. Nobody had to come in and make sure that continuity on me, or, you know, I could relate to the actors and the crew, and just it was more relaxed and I was less tired at the end of the day. But when you're acting in a scene that you're also directing, whether it's a love scene or a dialogue scene, it doesn't matter. You don't have time to really second guess yourself. You know, if you're prepared and you know your lines, you're listening, watching everything the other actor's doing opposite you, but you're also paying attention to everything that's within the frame, what's going to be seen on screen, you know, the light, the objects, everything. And so you're present. You're doing what you should always do as an actor, which is be in the moment, moment to moment, and present, and react. I mean, the foundation of really good acting, I think, is good reacting. That's how where it starts. And so I didn't need more than one or two takes usually, because I was available to the other actor as one always should be.
And I guess when you're getting what you were getting from Vicky Creeps, it's, it might by probably
helped
it a lot. But it makes me wonder now, is directing beginning to creep to the fore? Or it sounds as if you kind of like the dual role, in fact.
I like it. I do like it. I would, if I had my choice and the money was available to start shooting tomorrow, I would be directing another movie now. I mean, as soon as I'm done.
And acting in it or just directing?
The next one I'm likely to do, I won't be in it. No.
Now, it was when I was making the promo for tonight's program, I said, you know, I'll talk to Viggo Mortensen about acting, writing and producing. And then I watched the film. Oh, that's wonderful music. Who's the composer? And I waited for the credits to roll. Composer Viggo Mortensen. Who did he get to play his music? And I go, wait for that credit to come up. Yes, Viggo Mortensen is there again playing bass, guitar. was there another instrument in there? You weren't playing the cello.
Primarily piano. Yeah. The other instruments is just a little bit. And my friend Travis Dickerson, who recorded, who's also a musician and I've worked with for years, he played some little bits. But the primary instruments are first cello played by Cameron Stone, who also did play cello on the sort of the theme music for Game of Thrones, among other things. He's a really, really great musician. And Scarlett Rivera, who has done a lot of things and is very gifted and versatile. You know, she can play classical violin. She can play that Appalachian kind of Celtic sound that you hear as well. And she played with Bob Dylan in the 70s. And yeah, they're both very gifted. So that was great fun.
Yeah, and they had great music composed for them by one Viggo Mortensen. Viggo, it's been an absolute privilege and joy to speak with you. Congratulations on the film. Long may the multitasking continue for you and multi-role playing. Thanks so much for being with us on Arena.
Thank you, Sean.
Could be the piano playing of Viggo Mortensen that we are listening to there. Some of the music of the score there from the score for The Dead Don't Hurt. Composed, directed, written by and starring Viggo Mortensen, who spoke to me earlier. And The Dead Don't Hurt goes on general release from tomorrow. Yes, indeed. We'll be talking about that very novel presently on the programme, Kevin Barry's new novel, The Heart of Winter. But to film reviews first, or at this point at any rate, and this evening we will see some heavy and lighter hitters from the crime canon as we move from comedy thriller Hitman to Dublin-set gritty crime drama The Black Guelf. And there's some good news to the ears of Bad Boys fans as we see the release of the fourth instalment of the franchise. Hitman is where we're going to start. Co-written is the third on-screen project with Richard Linklater and Glenn Powell, based loosely on a true story. It follows a mild-mannered professor leading a double life as an academic and a fake contract hitman. Glenn Powell plays protagonist Gary Johnson alongside potential client but about to be love interest Adria Arjona as Maddie Masters. Bad Boys, Ride or Die sees the return of Will Smith and Martin Lawrence as they switch up their on-screen character chemistry in their fourth instalment of the franchise. And The Black Guelf, John Connor's fictional feature directorial, brings us into the gritty world of Dublin, Dublin's underbelly, telling the story of Canto, a small-time drug dealer who desperately needs to get off the streets of inner-city Dublin. With me in studio this evening, Hilary White and Tara Brady. And yes, indeed, you can watch us, if you are so inclined, on the live stream, rte.ie/arena. And let's start with Hitman, based loosely on a true story of Gary Johnson, an undercover law enforcement officer in Houston, Texas. Johnson specialized in posing as a hitman in exotic disguises, setting up meetings with potential clients, secretly taping them, and that, of course, led to the subsequent arrest and, in many cases, being charged with conspiracy to murder. Linklater and co-writer and star Glenn Powell have transposed the action to New Orleans and make their bogus assassin an earnest liberal arts professor called Gary. You know, when it started out at the beginning of this, did I say that who was with me in studio? I did, Hilary White and Tara Brady, yes. When I say, Tara, that this is based on a true story, I saw that at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then I thought, all right, they're just playing with this.
Yeah.
But there is actually a guy who did this job.
Yeah, there is. I think it probably is more accurate to say it's based on a genuine pack of lies, because I think there's always this sense that, because it's based on this like newspaper article that appeared about 20 years ago. But there's always a sense within that article and within the film that this could now, every part of this should be taken with a large pinch of salt. But as it's going along, it's, you don't really mind. You're happy to kind of roll with it, because it sets up this kind of lovely dichotomy with Glenn Powell, who's very much the man of the moment, as this mild mannered professor, and he's doing a real Clark Kent here, because he's just this kind of tech guy. He hangs out in a van with other kind of
loads of cats at home.
With other kind of tech guys, but one day he ends up being thrust into the spotlight, and he has to pose as the hitman. And amazingly, he takes to the role very, very well. So it's an entrapment scenario. He's going in. He's saying, "Yeah, I can kill your husband. Yeah, I can kill your enemy for you." And the police swoop in and arrest the guy.
They have to say something. They have to make it clear that they want the person killed, and they have to offer
a sting operation.
Yeah, yes. Basically. Yeah. Job done. Yeah. So here is the moment. The guy who was doing it previously has been beating up teenagers on the street, and the police force do not think that's a good idea to have him in this job. He's too visible now. Mm-hmm. So poor old Glenn Powell, as Gary Johnson, is sitting in the back of the van listening in, supposed to be listening in, but he's told, no, you've got a new job today.
Hey, Gary, we're thinking you're up.
I'm out. What is up?
Congrats, Gary. You just got promoted to contract killer.
Well, when you reschedule? He's not even here yet.
Hitmen don't cancel the first meeting.
Hitmen? Hitmen don't exist. What are we following made-up rules now?
You've seen this a million times. You can do it.
Why don't you do it?
No way. Tried years ago. Almost got killed.
I don't want to almost get killed either. Okay. I'm a civilian.
We got your back. We'll move in if it starts getting pear-shaped.
Clock's ticking. I need you to grab Jasper's wire.
And you might want to check this out real quick. That is everything we know so far, Billy.
What?
Your alias. Billy, let's go.
Oh, my God. I'm going to die.
There he is. So that's Glenn Powell being set up now to be the pretend hitman. So he has to take on a new name, which for the purposes of this particular setup is Billy. And we see that first setup, and it's quite funny, and you can see how he's trying to get the guy opposite him to kind of spill the beans and say the necessary sentence, Hillary.
Yeah, I mean, it brings out a real theatrical side in this guy. He's this, you know, very mild-mannered philosophy academic. I mean, at one stage, he sort of turns into this kind of Slavic Trent Reznor character in a big leather.
Ron.
Yeah, Ron as well. Yeah, Ron is the one that gets him into a lot of trouble because he is in the guise of Ron, who's a very kind of, you know, sleek, dark, smouldering hitman, when he meets Madison, played by Adria Arjona. And she is a battered wife. They meet in a quiet diner. And she is dipping her toe into the waters of finding somebody to bump off her horrible husband. And there's a spark between the two of them. And Gary finds himself trying to dissuade her from going down this route, saying, you know, this could really change your life. This is not the thing you want to do. You should take that money. You should run for the hills and start a new life. Anyway, long story short, a passionate romance breaks out between the two of them, one which is further inflamed by her belief that he is this dark, smouldering man of mystery.
Yeah, so this plays in this whole idea that the dangerous guy is the attractive guy. But Hillary, long story short, it certainly did make a long story short, because they show us about, I must be 15 or 20 setups, and you're thinking, we get the point. Mm-hmm. He pretends to be the hitman. He entraps the person. Can we get on with things?
Yeah. No, it does. But then once I think it gets to the point where he starts telling lies and he's in the position where he has to work out which lie does he tell, the film actually kind of comes into its own at that point. Mm. That's where it really takes off, and where you have that real sense of jeopardy all the way through.
He's painting himself into a corner.
Yeah, and that's,
well, he's
that's
gonna have
kind
to
of
tell
lovely.
If it's going to be a romantic comedy of some kind, he's going to have to spill the beans at some point, isn't he? He's going to have to say, I really am.
Yeah, there is,
or the
opportunity that he's going to like run into somebody that he's put in jail on the street, which becomes a very real fear. But it has this really lovely layer, like, as I was saying, like a genuine pack of lies, because he's a philosophy teacher. Then they put in on top of it this idea that he's going back to his students and asking, "What if yourself is a construct?" While he's going off and developing this very very elaborate construct, they keep things very very kind of light and frothy, so it never kind of gets into any dark place where it's like, but aren't these two people lying to each other? So the person that they've fallen for isn't real at all. You know, so it's a kind of glosses over that in favor of just like sheer entertainment value. But that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, and is it entertaining in that respect? I mean, Powell has a big job to do here, because he has to be the kind of the nerd, and he has to be potentially
the
sexy guy as well.
He co-wrote it with Linklater as well. I thought it was very entertaining. I thought he was great value for Powell, and I thought that, you know, those scenes where he tries on these different sort of cliched guises of hitmen were quite amusing, and I quite liked, you know, the sort of the slight ridiculous air that had almost kind of comic noir thing going on. But at the same time, there were these sort of themes about, you know, the self and the roles that we play, which are, you know, it's real Linklater territory, and a lot of his films kind of go into that, those sort of themes. But it wasn't
kind of philosophy light in some ways.
Yeah, it wasn't completely up itself in that way. Yeah. So I thought it was great fun, this, and it's a perfect date night film. I don't know how it's not getting a cinema release, because it's a no brainer for a couple to go out for bite to eat and see this.
It's not getting a cinema release because Netflix spent $20 million on it, buying it up. That's why. Yeah. That would be the answer to that question.
And is because it being on Netflix, is that what's allowing, I'm a little hobby horse now, is that what's allowing it to be, is it the guts of 2 hours long? I mean, this is a good short thriller stroke rom-com comedy. Get it in under an hour and a half. Thanks very much. I need to get home.
Yeah, no, I do think it goes on too long, and I think they spend kind of too much time on the setup. They spend too much time on sex scenes as well. That kind of goes on a little bit longer than, especially, like, you know, although it's interesting to see the sex scene back in a rom-com, because one of the points that Linklater makes is that, like, nobody makes romantic comedies with sex scenes in them anymore, and that was very much something that him and Powell set out to do. I don't know that this is pure indulgence, because it was bought up, but there was already a pre-existing relationship between Linklater and Netflix because he did that. He did the Apollo animation with them. So, you know, so maybe it was always on the cards.
Linklater and Powell, big. That's a. This is an ongoing relationship. Seems to be working.
Yeah. This is no. This is their third film together. And like Powell is now taking a step back from Hollywood to go back to college at the age of 35, and he will be very, very sorely missed. I mean, he really has come into his own as a movie star in the last year. Very much so.
The college applications will go up. I would guess as a result. Be, yeah. Can I go to the same college, please? So you had kind of fun, it sounds like, with this one.
Yeah, I definitely had fun. I mean, my only kind of I think it would have been nice if Madison had been more than sexy girl, because that's not really a full personality. Not really.
Yeah.
Especially in a film where there's all these like elaborate layers to the male character, it would have been nice if there was a little bit more.
They really just play her as
but she does really well with it.
She really does
have a lot of screen charisma, and that kind of offsets the sort of underwriting.
Stars?
3.5.
3.5. For you, does it work overall?
4 for me, slightly too long, but I had a lot of fun with it. I think viewers will too.
All right. 4, 3.5 and 4 respectively then. Hitman is the title of the film. Let's move on to film number 2, Bad Boys 4, Ride or Die. What do I need to know? My favourite question in the franchise area. What do I need to know about Bad Boys 1, 2 and 3 if I'm going to come to Bad Boys 4?
Okay. Bad Boys 1, 2 and 3, we have to go way back in history to 1995, and Will Smith is still, you know, is still best known as the French Prince, Prince of Bel-Air at this point. So and this would have been, like, he had already been at Independence Day and things, but this would have been a really kind of big movie. And it was quite significant that there were two black actors in the movies, because it very much belonged to the kind of Die Hard, 48 Hours, slightly comic. Yeah. Well, one of the things I did note was that at Lethal Weapon 4 is the one where Mel Gibson's Riggs character gets married, and this one has the white boy getting married in it. So it's perfectly following the logic of the big 80s kind of franchise juggernaut. Yeah.
Lethal Weapon got 4 films in a decade as well. These guys are taking 3 decades to
get around to the same thing. So anyway, Marcus, played by Martin Lawrence, he's the kind of clownish, cautious one, and Will Smith is the cool guy. He's the guy. He comes from money, and he drives a Porsche. He drives a Porsche really fast as well. Yeah. He waves his gun around. He never loses his cool. So this film, however, kind of flips that narrative a little bit, because at the very beginning we have Martin Lawrence having a heart attack, and because he survives the heart attack, he thinks, well, I am immortal now. Nothing can kill me. So he's walking around, standing on the edges of buildings, and suddenly Will Smith is the one who is more nervy.
Right.
So that, and they have really good fun with that. And
they're kind of swapping character traits, and they're a little bit older now, so they're in the later stages of life. How philosophical have they become?
Getting too old.
Or grumpy old men,
as they say. I mean, one of the things that emerges through this film is Will Smith's character is actually also starting to get panic attacks. So there is this sense of vulnerability about them while they're facing down this dreadful terrorist threat, which is, has infiltrated the Miami Police Department and has smeared their previous late great Captain Howard, played by Joe Pantoliano, who is now being attached to a cartel. And so the two of them, Mike and Marcus, set out to try and clear his name. And in doing so, they get smeared themselves and they go on the run. And so there's a lot of clutching backs and, oh no, my murmurs are going again. How much longer can we keep this up?
That sounds a bit overhand, is it?
I thought it was. I found that with this film, the relationship between the two of them was, there was too much an autopilot. It was too much this kind of cartoonish, bang, 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 silly interlude, silly bit of banter from the Marcus character, more bang, 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 swirling around, sort of first person gamer shots with the gun, like you're playing Dune or something like this.
You're nodding a lot in agreement with a lot of that, I think, Tara, are you?
Yeah, I do think so. I think it does feel a little bit, it feels very old fashioned, because it's that Lethal Weapon, sort of queasy, very American blend of family values and gun-toting and gun-waving.
And there's a strip that club scene, like the obligatory strip club
scene. And then the NRA pop up for some reason. The thing that I thought carried it through, because I certainly don't think the plot is there. The actual crime solving, they keep getting clues on a laptop, and it's like what if you're recording clues for people, wouldn't you actually say where you're supposed to go instead? And you know, it felt like one of like Coco Melon Lane or like Blue's Clues or one of those shows, the kids shows, where you're putting together things, you know, in order to, you know, find your porridge bowl.
And I thought the plot was too busy. It was too convoluted. Very busy. There's characters popping up three quarters of the way through saying, "Oh, I've got a vendetta as well," and you're going, "Who is this person?" And you know,
oh no, he was in three, and I
and the son
three.
Who they spring
yes,
from
that
jail.
Was three. Yes, that was three. Yes.
But I'm guessing if you've been a fan of the Bad Boys franchise, you'd probably come out smiling from this one, will you, Tara?
I definitely think so. I think that even when the script lets them in the dialogue, they have so much chemistry together. Like they work really well, and they even have a little bit of fun where Martin Lawrence has to slap Will Smith a few times to snap him out of a panic attack. And I think we all know what that refers to. But I also like as well, like I thought Martin Lawrence sort of stole the show for me, because I think he took being the confident one, but also managed to keep his traditional kind of clowning buffoonery skills intact. So I thought he was I enjoyed that.
It has to be Oscar nominated just for that clip to be played, please. I guess that's what everybody will want. You'd nominate it for that alone, wouldn't you? Just for the badness. Okay, is it a bit of fun? And it sounds like a bit of fun. Stars?
I'll give it three for nostalgia reasons. I've seen all of them since I was not that young, but quite young.
You were younger
than we are now.
Okay. And you, Hilary?
I didn't have quite as much fun with it. It's 2.5 from me. I agree with what Tara was saying about the Marcus character. I thought he was the most well-defined character, but that's kind of damning with faint praise. I didn't think the action was good enough, and I didn't find it funny enough. Two and a half.
The Martin Lawrence character is the one that Marcus is. Martin Lawrence is
that's Martin
Lawrence.
Yes.
So he's the better character for you in this. And what did you say, sorry, Hilary? 2.5?
2.5.
Two and a half was, I think, what we were. You know, three. You were three.
I'm three, yeah. I'm not sending you to the voting booth.
I still want that clip. I will vote for that in the Oscars above any great film I've seen, just to see that clip played in the ceremony. Let us move on to our third and final film, Black Gelf, marks John Connor's fiction feature film directorial debut. The film premiered at Germany's Oldenburg Festival, where it won Best Film and Best Actor for Graham Early. The narrative tells the story of Canto, which is the character played by Graham Early, small-time drug dealer who desperately needs to get off the streets of inner-city Dublin. His absent father, Dan, played by Paul Rowe, Paul Rowe who plays the father in it, yes, he returns to reconcile his past before something much worse takes control of both their lives. This is a familiar territory. We're in gritty inner city Dublin. Are we getting something new here, or what angle are we getting into it from John Connors?
Well, I think what we're getting is like something very, very ambitious, and you can tell that from the title. Like the title both refers to like Dante's Inferno, which this film can feel a little bit like sometimes, but it's also about the political factions in 13th century like medieval Italy and the ones who supported the Pope and the against the incoming German emperors. So the fact that it has that tells you really what you need to know, because this is a very, very kind of layered script. Like what it tries to do is delve into intergenerational trauma. So you have this like main story, which is Graham Early's Canto. He's a typical kind of ne'er-do-well from, you could have met him in any kind of Dublin gangster film. You know, he's a kind of drug peddler. Yeah. He doesn't look after his kids. You know, he's estranged from his father. He's in trouble with the law. So you have all that going on. But in on top of that, then you have the father's story, it was Paul Rowe's story, and that concerns like clerical abuse and that. And so it's tying all those things together, and it does that very well, and it has very, very good performances to do that.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me when watching some of it today, Hilary, was the nature of the dialogue. It had a real improvised feel of it, but not... Sometimes you get the improvised feel and it's messy and there's overlapping and you know that it's just they're not leaving space for each other to speak. But this had real feel that I felt I was in the room. It was almost fly on the wall documentary. Of course, John Connors had directed documentary previously.
He had, an IFTA winning documentary all about his traveller heritage.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree with you. I thought that the register in this was absolutely pitch perfect, very authentic. I thought they made great use of the location sets around Ring's End, where they filmed most of this. And I thought the performances were really committed as well, like all across the board. Paul Rowe, who plays Dan, I thought had some incredibly magnetic Father. Moments, yeah. just where Connors lingers on him for a bit and just lets him fill a space, like that scene where he arrives back and he's sort of squatting in a derelict room. That was an amazing piece of filming, I thought.
Yeah, there was real bravery, and particularly in that scene, I thought, Tara, you know, that opening, we kind of know who the main character, then out pops this other character, who's this fella arriving back? And John Connors just lets the camera follow him into this building. We look around the building, we're told nothing, there's no dialogue, there's no other character present. That's really strong cinematic type of filming.
There's a really clever visual thing going on, whereas you're in like really tiny rooms in like where people are crowded around tables, usually, you know, snorting cocaine or packing cocaine or doing something similar, you know, or you're in these kind of strange spaces, and very often they're quite dark spaces, and it has this like slightly, it's quite unnerving, and you get, again, goes back to that theme of the inferno, like it like sort
there's
of
a barge
feels
as well.
Yeah, it feels slightly hellish all the time. Yeah. But then that becomes sort of a problem, because I think, you know, if you think about really great socialist realist drama, like even the most depressing ones, there's always usually a sense, like, you know, if you can think about the saddest films by, say, the Dan Brothers or Ken Loach, there always has to be some pathway out for the whereas like this opens with this story about crabs always pulling each other back down when they try to crawl out of a bucket, and it feels like that. It feels like there's never any way out.
Stars from you in this one, Tara?
Three. I mean, I just think it's just a little too grim for me.
But certainly
a lot of potential in there. Very authentic.
Yeah, and Hilary?
Yeah, I'm going to go with four. I think thought the length of it was slightly a problem. You know, allowing for those sort of extended scenes, I just thought a little bit could have shaved off, but I thought there was a lot of really, really good work here. I think Connors is one to watch, certainly.
Definitely.
All right. John Connors, the director and co-writer there, co-wrote it with Tiernan Williams. Tara Brady and Hilary White are two reviewers this evening. Hitman lands on Netflix tomorrow. Bad Boys Ride or Die is in cinemas as of today. And The Black Gelf is available to buy on morphed.tv from tomorrow. The Heart of Winter is award-winning writer Kevin Barry's first novel, set in America. It's the tale of young lovers on the in 1890s Montana, the city of Butte, Montana, rich in copper mines and rampant with vice and debauchery among a hard-living crowd of immigrant Irish workers. The story tracks the dangerously forbidden affair between Tom Work, a young degenerate poet and balladeer, and Polly Gillespie, the devout wife of a powerful mine captain called Long Anthony Harrington. They flee west on a stolen horse, traversing Montana and Idaho, enjoying a brief idyll of wild romance. However, there's a bundle of Cornish gunmen after them, with San Francisco a distant hope. Their perilous choices will haunt them forever. Richard Albus has been reading The Heart of Winter for us, and he joins me now on the line. Montana in the late 1880s, in the late 1800s, I kind of feel we're back to the Viggo Mortensen film we talked a little bit earlier on. Kevin Barry himself has described this as a Western with Cork accents. Does that sound a good description to you, Richard?
Yeah, it really does. And hello, Sean. It is actually a funny combination of precisely what you just described there, with real grittiness and earthiness. But it, in some ways, it also has some characteristics of the other films that you were discussing, you know, Bad Boys and so on, because this is a kind of a classic chase on the run kind of novel. So it's a curious combination. And there are definitely elements of it that feel very cinematic, feel like TV series like Deadwood and even the futuristic Westworld. So it's a really complex but very, very gripping novel.
Kevin Barry has said that the novel was in gestation or in development for over 25 years. Now, I know he's pretty much a master of the short story form. There have been obviously novels in there as well. But do you get that sense of a long gestational period in this novel when you're reading it?
Yeah, I was quite surprised when I read that, because there's a speed and a dynamism to this book that doesn't really suggest something which I think in one interview I read, he said that, you know, he wrote parts of the book many years ago and then just put it under the bed. You know, quite often with books that go under the bed, they're there for a reason, because the idea isn't very good. That is not the case with this one. And as I say, the kind of the prose is very, very direct. I mean, this is even though it's a complex book, it's a very quick, very engaging read.
And I think he said it was when, Kevin Barry said it was when he started to pursue the character of Molly and give her more, or Polly, I beg your pardon, Polly Gillespie, who's this devout wife of the powerful mine captain. When he started to pursue her voice, that was when the novel began to open up for him. Tell us a bit about her and about the relationship that develops between her and Tom Rourke.
Yeah, so I mean, they're both Irish immigrants. Polly Gillespie is what, you know, then would have been described as like a mail order bride in some ways, from Chicago. That Tom Rourke, one of the ways in which he made extra money was by writing letters to Irish women in cities saying, "Hey, come to Montana, marry someone, you'll live in a really nice house." So Polly Gillespie is kind of part of that group of people, and she arrives in Butte, and as you say, she's to be married to this character Harrington, who's very straight-laced, very devout. He flagellates himself vigorously before sex and so on. And then she meets Tom, and it's just one of those things where they're just like two similar characters. They immediately fall in love and straight away decide that they're going to run off together. And as you said in your introduction, they do that classic Western thing that they steal a horse and off they go, and a chase ensues.
And this all in wild Cork accents. How did that sit with you, and this portrayal of the Irish community at the time?
Yeah, I mean, it is one of the things that is very, very striking about the book. I mean, you're right that this is place, Butte in Montana, copper mining town. It was somewhere that was full of Irish immigrants who were working in those mines, and so, you know, absolutely, the use of language is very idiomatic. One of the things that is very striking is how unsentimental Kevin Barry is about those characters. That, I mean, he, one of the characteristics of the book is that the language is very, very strong. So I can't even quote most of the things. But, you know, at different times when he sees he's in a bar, he sees a kind of a fellow Irishman kind of drunk there, and he says, you know, "I hated to be wistful for home." He hated sentimental, I'm going to edit out here, so-and-so, singing through the streets of the small hours about the hell holes that had vomited them out. That is a theme of the entire book. So, you know, there isn't a kind of a sentimentality or a romanticization of what is going on here. It's actually, in many ways, very stark about Ireland, the Irish, and that 19th century immigrant experience.
Yeah, I saw a clip of him today. I think it was in Kenny's Bookshop in Dublin, where he was, or in Galway, I beg your pardon, where he was reading from the novel. And he's a wonderful reader of his own work. And he had all these character voices within it. It's full of dialogue and full of great dialogue. And again, read him talking about the fact that he met lots of people who had maybe in a previous generation the Butte experience, or he read their stories. It seemed to have been quite a big thing, this Irish community in Butte, Montana.
And I think that's actually one of the things that makes the book so interesting, that you do have this kind of varied experience. It's one of the reasons that the book, for all the fantasy, and actually there's quite a lot of hallucination in the book as well, due to drugs. But there is a kind of an intense realism to it, that somewhere like Butte, you really do get a kind of a granular sense of what life was like there, how harsh it was to be out in these kind of places. That, as I say, this is not a romanticized, dewy-eyed kind of view at all.
But there is a kind of a realism, as you say, even within all those, the hallucinatory aspect, drug-induced for the most part, there is a very realistic side to the story as well. Did you pick up contemporary resonances in any of that realism?
I think that, I mean, clearly reading this book about immigration and the way that immigrants kind of assimilate, but also the way in which immigrants are treated, obviously has some contemporary resonance. And I think as well that it really spoke to me about the way in the kind of very nuanced way in which Ireland and the Irish think about this now, which I think is different to earlier generations. That I've just started the new Colm Tobin book, which is a follow-on from Brooklyn about and about Long Island. And again, it's about that experience of somebody Irish moving to America and kind of living within these immigrant, other immigrant communities. So I think that, you know, clearly this is kind of something that intrigues other writers. Sebastian Barry has written about it. Joseph O'Connor has written about it. So I think it's something that really appeals to the Irish literary imagination.
And as a reader, there's clear enjoyment, as I say, when I watch that clip of Kevin Barry reading from it. There's such enjoyment in the way he relishes the prose and the characters. Does that enjoyment transfer to the reader?
It does. I mean, it's really beautifully beautifully written, but in this very urgent, direct way. And it did. I remember reading Beetlebone, one of his earlier books, which was a much drier kind of book. This is a much more visceral experience. And I'd struggle to describe it as an enjoyable read, but it's a really engaging read. You know, as you're kind of going along, you're gripped by it. Mm. And as I say, it has almost this kind of cinematic TV script element to it, that you can visualize things. He's a brilliant writer for conjuring these kind of images and constructing dialogue between different characters. And
wonderful set pieces, very common across all the novels and the short stories, in fact, as well. And he's Kevin Barry has hinted that there's a potential for more stories from Butte, Montana, maybe a film or a television series or a sequel to this. How would you see that possibly?
I absolutely see this as being something that he would write about. As I say, I mean, these series like Deadwood, and he hints at that at the end of the book, where one of the characters later on is working in a cinema, and this character, who obviously I won't reveal, says, you know, you haven't seen anything. I could show you much more than anything you can see here on the screen. The one other thing that kind of struck me is that right at the very beginning, the epigraph is from Mary MacLean, the Canadian writer, the Wild Woman of Butte, she was called. And it's, "I do not see beauty in self-restraint." Now, he chose that epigraph for a reason, because there is no self-restraint in this book. And that's part of what makes it so gripping.
Worth the read. Very gripping, it seems to be your judgment. Am I right in saying that, Richard?
Yeah, absolutely. As I say, it was very quick, very engaging, very, very dramatic.
Lovely.
But, you know, readers need to prepare themselves. This is like a smack in the face sometimes.
There we go. Richard Aldous speaking to us there about The Heart of Winter by Kevin Barry, which is published by Canongate, and that's our lot for this Thursday evening. Barbara Rose Sanwell and Leah Murphy were the researchers. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.